Thank you for joining us today. I'm your host, Tracy Bennett. In studio with me are certified financial planners, Tyler Cook and Tony Payne. And today we're going to be talking about grasping how our minds affect investing. Markets go up, markets go down. We deal with this every day. You guys deal with the stress of it all with our clients. Kind of want to go through some talk points, and I'll be using my outline heavily here. So pick your brain a little bit.
Well, I think the way we intro'd even is kind of funny for this topic, because in the office, sometimes we'll have meetings. Often I have meetings, and depending on the market, I'll hear people come in the door and someone greet them. How are you doing today? And they'll kind of laugh and go, well, it depends on the market. And it's like, well, that's not always the right answer. That's not how you should feel, hopefully. But it's just natural sometimes that when markets are going down or up, you kind of run with that, whether it's a positive or a negative. So that's some of that behavioral finance and how it bleeds through that we're talking about.
Yeah, and from the layperson's point of view, when you watch the news and you hear the media talking about the markets and the economy, it can be really scary for those of us who don't, you know, eat, sleep, drink, and breathe this industry. So we rely on, you know, you guys to keep us lifted up and optimistic about things. And that's probably a lot of pressure for you sometimes when you get a worrisome client.
I mean, it can be. I think just going back to what you see on the news too, there's a big red words, there's green words, there's things slashing at you and yelling at you. So trying to block that out and figure out, okay, what's actually happening right now. That's where we come in, is certainly with market volatility, to kind of be that calming influence and just reset on what the bigger goal is and what's really changed since yesterday. You ask yourself that. Did anything really change fundamentally? Sometimes it does. And we've been in, just look at the last 10 to 15 years, there's been a lot of things that's happened in our world, obviously here in the States, but also globally, that could create fear, could create emotion. It certainly moves the markets, and it makes for good headlines, which is ultimately what they're trying to sell you, right, when you see these things. So trying to just center yourself around what the goals are, what the long-term outlook looks like, and ask yourself, what actually changed? Did anything change?
And that's where the idea of separating news from noise, I think, really is important, because in an era where we are now, where news is content, and I can't run a news channel if I don't have content, well, I have to have content every single day. Does it mean that it was really earth-shattering content or market-moving content, or was it truly a slow news day that I'm filling with some other story? Mm-hmm. And if I'm just watching that after coming home from work and looking at my 401k, sometimes it's hard to filter news from noise. So like you were saying, Tyler, that's really important to be able to do, and hopefully with a well-thought-out strategy, you're not reacting to news or noise.
Yeah, there seems to be two different personality types. The statement readers, you know, that live and die by the monthly statements or their spreadsheets, or get online and look at what's going on in the market. And those that are just, you know, riding the wave. And from the advisor perspective, we've done a couple of shows on what is a financial advisor. From the behavioral finance perspective, this is a big part of what you do. It's not just a game of numbers from my perspective, from watching you guys over the years.
Yeah.
It seems to be you're a mentor, you're a marriage counselor, you're a referee sometimes. So what do you do when things are kicking up to prepare yourself for these conversations to help people tamp down those nerves?
Well, while we are not psychologists, psychiatrists, there's a field called behavioral finance. So as we've learned in part of continuing education and just being in the network and going to conferences and listening to the experts, the idea of how does behavioral finance play into people? And it's really important because everyone is a little different. Their money imprint from when they were younger, the ideas that helped form who they are today, they're all a little different. And that plays into how you handle money, how you react. And as we know that and can be aware of that, it's sometimes using those things that are unique to that one person to be able to have a discussion that aligns with them or it clicks with them, that, you know what, that makes sense to me. Because sometimes the most important thing an advisor can do isn't what they recommend doing, but what they recommend not doing.
Mm-hmm. Great point.
Yeah, you mentioned the behavioral finance, I'll call it a trend, but it's obviously been a thing for a long time. These big institutions and organizations have caught on to that, and they actually have in-house psychologists.
Really?
Who help not only coach their staff, but also put out content for their clients.
Yeah.
So it's a real thing. I mean, that's trying to stay up to date with that. The conferences we attend, there's a lot of great speakers and things. What I always take away from those is there's something that, again, I use the word centered yourself a lot, but that's really the key, is when the noise is around you, you've got to be able to find kind of your grounding spot to then just realize, okay, look at your feet, where you're at. That's where I am today. What's happening now in the background? Is that really going to affect the horizon, right? Where I'm going? Mm-hmm. And oftentimes the answer is no. Mm-hmm. And I think our process is designed to meet regularly with people so that we are ahead of these things and we're proactive. And so like when the, like, for example, 2025, that year has been a case study in market volatility for many reasons. You know, tariffs got a lot of headlines. The Fed had headlines. Russia, Ukraine, Israel, Hamas, Iran, all that stuff moves markets and it makes for good headlines.
Yeah.
With investing, right? But then sending yourself around, did it actually impact me long term? Or even go back to COVID. You look, we chart our progress with clients over time. And I look at these charts and see where they're probably, it's hard to say where was COVID on the chart now? In the middle of it, in the middle of that storm, it always is very uncertain and emotional. But the good investors, going back to that concept, the good investors block out the emotions.
Okay, psychological biases in investing. We talked a little bit about that. But common cognitive biases that affect investment decisions, such as anchoring, confirmation bias, availability bias, and exploring how these biases can lead to suboptimal investment outcomes during market fluctuations. I mean, you kind of touched on that a little bit, but
yeah.
Well, to not maybe use the high level terms, but just use examples almost. Mm-hmm. You know what, if I worked for an insurance company and that's my life, that's what I do. I sell insurance, I get the marketing materials. I'm engrossed in that. That's my life. Well, then when it comes to my own personal financial plan, typically I may be more biased or insurance heavy on things because that's my bias. That's my internal, what's around me, what's right in front of me. And that alone is something to be aware of. It doesn't mean you're doing that. You might know those things in and out. You might get a great discount on them. But the idea of, am I aware that I'm only picking these because that's my world and what's right in front of me, that's one of those biases.
Yeah, we see that a lot in the scenario where somebody gets stock options. So they're not only is their paycheck derived by what they're doing for the business, they believe in it. They're seeing the value driven by what's happened to the stock price. The employer gives them shares of stock as a, you know, incentive and reward. And so it can be kind of hard to let go of that. But that's where we kind of come in to guide. Here's your overall exposure to this individual company. I know it's your livelihood, but it's probably a good idea to look at some diversification. And that's hard because your brain's thinking as the person who works for that company, like, I know what I'm doing. I'm driving value. Mm-hmm. But diversifying is so critical.
And part of what we've learned over the years are questions to ask someone to hopefully get to suffocating logic. You know, you come at the answer yourself. So the idea of if that company were to give you that stock option in cash, would you go out and buy the company stock or would you go off and pay off debt?
Great question.
And that gets the gears turning. And now all of a sudden, hey, it's just another way for them to pay me that might be easier for them. Mm-hmm. But again, those biases kind of come, oh, this is my investment. That's investment.
Would that be considered emotional investing?
Definitely.
No, absolutely.
Yeah. That would fall into that category.
Yeah.
As I've read about this, there's such a role of emotions when you're dealing with money as we're kind of going through, but not just fear and regret, which I think we all have in some form, but greed, you know, and anxiety and shaping investor behavior during our market ups and downs, I think would be very heightened in that situation.
Yeah, we've kind of talked about the positive side of seeing like a stock grow and you want to be participating in that. But the other side's true is where, and I saw this back in 2008, people were hesitant to just put money to work in a downturn. Now, if you look historically, now 17 years ago, 2008 was a buying opportunity of a lifetime for people who had the cash to do it, right? So that you can sit on the sidelines too long is my point, because you let the fear get in the way. Oh my gosh, the world's ending. And we're bombarded with those things, newsletters, and there's a lot of aggressive marketing and really just negative tactics that are out there to play on your psyche with that. Mm-hmm. So sitting on the sidelines can be just as worse as getting too high on the upswings.
Yeah. Another example, I'll maybe hopefully use this one the right way, but confirmation bias. If you're somebody who's always been anti-something, I don't know what it is, but you've already had that mentality that, you know what, this is not going to work out. And all of a sudden that stock goes down and you go, aha, I knew it. I was right.
Yeah.
That's that confirmation, and it works both ways. That's the easier one. But when you're right and that confirmation bias reinforces you to say, it worked that time, it'll work again. That's the other piece too, where you have to be really disciplined with your investing and not emotional. And these are emotional, these are behavioral finance things that play in beyond just, did you analyze the numbers?
Talking about market sentiment and investment behavior. So I want you to explain how this influences an investor's behavior and decisions, including the impact of like social media, news headlines, market rumors, the stuff that we live and breathe.
Yeah, I tend to, at least when I'm scrolling and doing stuff like everybody else, I'll see it's the extreme one way or the other. It's never really the just kind of consistent approach that works, but they're talking about the boom's coming, the bus is coming, buy this, sell that. It's never just the real strategies that actually work for most people. They're trying to sell something typically on fear and emotions. Mm-hmm. That's what sells, of course. So trying to block that out is so bad. We saw it in COVID. I'll go back to that with AMC and GameStop. Think of all the things that happened there. Just our younger populations and what they got kind of brain trained into. Mm-hmm. And it's in front of you. It's constantly in front of you. And so I always ask myself, at least, just, you know, what's the take on this? What is somebody selling me? Because if you look like the newsletters that come out and it's like buy gold or sell gold or buy whatever, when you scroll down to the bottom and kind of look at the fine print, they're typically selling a book. They're selling something, right? There's some other incentive there, and they use that fear of the investment world to get you to click.
And thinking about market sentiment too, I mean, you see the gray hairs. We've been around long enough, I'm including you too, to see 2001 and 2, so the tech bubble right after that burst. I mean, the idea that any company that added .com to the name suddenly got a higher valuation. It was exciting. The internet's coming. This is the future. Well, we know that was true. Part of that was true. But then there were also tons of companies that went under that weren't able to take advantage of technology. And I can't help but think market sentiment today around AI. You know, you hear AI is the future, everything's going to take over. Well, again, which company, which type, how will it be used? So market sentiment, oh yeah, throw any dart at a board at AI, it'll work. We could be in a bubble right now, similar to 2000, 2001. So not saying that we are, but again, look at the market sentiment when it's all going one way. Sometimes that corrects itself.
Yeah, and that speaks to the herd mentality too. Right? People start chasing things and move all in one direction. Eventually, it's going to correct. And if you haven't diversified and done the right things, you're going to get clobbered. So you can even throw crypto into that too. And that's where I think the greed piece comes in, is people are chasing returns, not analyzing the actual underlying investments. And that's not a knock on crypto. I'm just saying that there's, in general, people's mindset is focused on return, return, return. How can I make more money? Which making money is great. But are you taking too much risk? And it's when things are up, you're like, oh, I can do this. I can take another risk. When things are down, you go too low. You're like, oh my gosh, this is awful. I'm going to sit on the sidelines, put everything in cash. So we come in as that voice of reason to balance the two. And again, keep perspective on what's the horizon looks like, not just today.
More of the behavioral finance. I mean, you're using the words regret even. I mean, regret plays into decision-making and your next decision sometimes. So again, recognizing these biases, being able to acknowledge it. You know, that water cooler talk, what you missed out on, that's okay, that might be real, but how many things did they not tell
exactly. you? Exactly. At the water cooler, they're not talking about the 10 that missed for the one that hit. You know, they don't talk about the losers.
Yeah, right. Part of that bias. Well, you know, the winners, they feel great. The losers hurt more. Mm-hmm. So keep that in mind, too. The losers hurt more than the winners win.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I want to explain what investment decision-making framework looks like and if it's relevant to the lay or if that's more of an industry function of what you do. So in other words, strategies for making investment decisions, fundamental analysis, technical analysis, behavioral considerations. I want to kind of explore how to incorporate these into a framework, into an investment strategy that kind of accounts for the market volatility and how people perceive it.
I think, first of all, you have to be real with yourself. Who's going to run this? Who's picking my strategy? Who's managing this? Because the idea that, yes, you are always the boss, that's true. And you could choose to hire someone. You could choose to go a direction. Again, we know that there are numerous ways that someone's been able to build a successful retirement, but usually it comes back to being consistent, being informed, using experts. So each of these can have, real estate could have an approach, investing in markets could have an approach, having a closely held business could work. But the idea of be consistent and have those experts, be willing to challenge some of your, I'll say old time thoughts, is really important.
No, nothing to add to that. I agree. That really covers it in a nutshell.
How do you build resilience? This talks about building resilience in investing.
Yeah, you got to go through some
what
tough times.
What does that
times.
Even mean?
Yeah, you got to go through the tough times and have the stomach to get through it.
So you're saying.
So like I'll use 2008, right? Don't get me wrong. 2008 was horrible from an economic scenario. Subprime loan crisis. Remember all that? I mean, it was a real thing. But the market's reaction, the S&P dropped over 50% during that great recession, it's now called. I this is my belief, just individual belief, but I believe a lot of that downside was worsened by people's emotions getting in, didn't have the gall to get through it, and just said, I'm out. And so that drove prices.
Bought into the rhetoric.
Yeah, and it drove the markets further south than maybe they should have gone. Mm-hmm. That's not to say, again, it wasn't a bad economic environment, because it was. But same things on the other side is, when do you get back in? You start playing that game and you start second guessing yourself. And so you have to go through some market cycles. And if you have a coach like us on your side to help that can certainly bring a lot of value. But the one thing you shouldn't do is take extremes one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you think about, again, I can't help it, 2000, 2001, people joke about millennials and how many times the markets have corrected. But I think that's the point, though. They still keep correcting. So the idea of that bias of, oh, I don't want to do that, the housing market, this rigged thing or whatever, you have missed out consistently the last 15 years, and that's not going away, I think. So the idea of being able to be aware sometimes of those biases, there's a lot of people that got soured on the market and have really missed out because of when they came of age, you know, what the market was doing when they got their first job. Yeah. And if you tie it into somebody who got their first job the last 5 or 10 years, you see a lot more good investors right now, younger people willing to put money in. And part of that is they've been rewarded right away, versus if you started and the first 4 or 5 years were down, you're going to question whether or not investing was the right thing for you.
Right, versus somebody in 2007, 2008, that they call it the lost decade now, when the market plummeted back then and it wiped out gains for a 10-year period. If you let that scare you and you didn't put money into work put money to work by saving it and investing it, oh, that was you.
I was that
yeah.
person.
Okay, yeah.
That was before I knew this company, and I was that person.
Yeah.
It's real.
I'm a worrier.
It's a real thing. And I think, too, just going forward, what you said is really critical for people to understand. When you're talking about the stock market, when I get that question about the fear thing of I don't want to be invested, I say, well, what are you actually investing in when you put your money into these mutual funds or index funds or stocks, whatever? And it kind of get there for the answer, suffocating logic. But at the end of the day, it's business. You're investing in business. So for things to really totally go to zero, which is what people worry about, every business would have to fail. Just think about that.
Yeah, that's a good perspective.
We've been through a lot of crap, right? Businesses find a way through it, is my point.
Yeah.
Certainly here in the States, capitalism is a thing, right? That they find a way to adjust to tax laws, to whatever, wars, whatever it is. Good businesses find a way through. Some don't make it. It's mm-hmm. true. That's why you diversify. Mm-hmm. So ask yourself, why are you investing first? What's your goal? And then what are you actually investing in? And if it's the markets, well, you're investing in business. And unless you think all businesses are going to zero, you're going to succeed in the long run.
Yeah, I think you pretty much just addressed the next point, which was risk perception and tolerance. So analyzing how people perceive and assess risk differently, how variations in risk tolerance can influence investment strategies and reactions to market volatility.
That's a really cool one. I like it because it's part of what we do. You see somebody, you don't want to bias them with what we know. We might know markets are up. You know what, over time, this is the way to go. It's not about how we feel, though. It's about how you feel and how you'd sleep at night and whether or not you can stick with it. Because the worst thing in the world is you think somebody's a robot or just on an Excel spreadsheet that they can deal with that down 50% you mentioned. But if they were already not in the position, they were already a little iffy, if you had the benefit of, you know what, you're not going to be overly aggressive and we're going to be a little bit more conservative, they may have been able to stay along the course, stay in the market, because they didn't see everything they built go down 50%. Granted, it's gone up quite significantly yeah. since then. But if you were somebody who reacted and couldn't stomach it, well, it was much more valuable to just be in a little bit rather than be in all the way and overdo it and not feel good about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, speaking to risk tolerance, I cringe so hard when I hear, just if I'm at a cocktail party or dinner or whatever and somebody finds out what we do and they, of course, they want to talk investments, which is, you know, as we know, just a small piece of what we do. But that's often the starting conversation. And I'll hear somebody say something like, you know, my so-and-so relative or my parents, you know, they couldn't retire because of 2008. And I'm thinking to myself, how is that even possible? Because it speaks to risk tolerance. If your retirement was jeopardized because of 2008, you weren't doing the proper proactive planning on your allocation targets in advance. You were too aggressive in some sense. Or the other side of that is you saw the, you know, the storm coming and you sold out and never got back in, right? It's those things. So I think to myself, oh, it doesn't compute with me, of course, because we do it every day. But for somebody that's not, it's not in front of them, it was so obvious.
Well, you're looking at the analytical side. You're non-emotional. You guys are able to compartmentalize.
I'm very emotional.
the old adage, information is power.
Yeah.
When you're confident in the knowledge that you have, you can be less emotional and more straightforward about the way you approach something. So for the lay who don't have that analytical side and ability to understand the industry as a whole, the fear is real, you know, especially with the with social media and all of the influences out there.
And I can't help but run with that example. I mean, again, if you are already nervous about investing and the one investment you have is in your company stock, you're so overconcentrated. Again, you're thinking that you're not exposed to the market maybe, or, hey, I've just got my company, my stock, the thing I know. You're taking more risk. But again, the idea of not having that diversification, not participating, again, that's going to backfire, I think, eventually. But again, it's about having that check with yourself. You know what? Am I really in a neutral position? Because if you're not, take a step back and say, you know what? In regular times, how would I feel about this?
This has been a great conversation. Thanks so much. I've learned a lot. I hope you have. The moral of the story is get as much help as possible. Learn, get into the details, seek the help of a certified financial planner. We appreciate your time. We hope you'll tune in again. Thanks for joining us.
Media, think big.